This is disc number 10.
The impact of the horses running at full speed clouding into a tangled pile of broken men and animals blocking the main road was ghastly. Flesh pounded against flesh and bones snapped. Horses screamed in pain. So powerful was the force of the impact that it broke the spike wall and blew a hole through the bottleneck of carcasses. Great war horses, some with their face armor and some without, spilled through the gap, slipping and sliding on the blood and gore of slain comrades and other animals. In the treacherous footing, some of the horses and riders fell. Others, pouring through the gap at a full gallop, didn't have anywhere else to go and trampled them. Men bristling with spears rushed out of alleyways to the sides and into the path of the charging cavalry to close the breach in the line. The horses, already in shock from the carnage and terrible destruction of so many of their kind, now faced rank upon rank of men running in at them, yelling battle cries, thrusting spears into their sides. The animals squealed with horrific, desperate screams as they were mercilessly gored. The fallen animals tripped up those still running in an attempt to escape. The evening air sounded as if it were ripping as archers rained down a hail of arrows on cavalrymen struggling to escape the carnage. Nicky doubted that these Imperial Order troops would have deliberately attacked into the city, using the cavalry in such a fashion, if they had not been goaded into it. These kind of horses were not meant for this kind of fighting. They simply couldn't maneuver properly in the close quarters, and the cavalrymen couldn't effectively cut down their opposition. To make matters more difficult for them, the defenders had too many places to hide for a cavalry charge to be truly effective. The purpose of the cavalry would have been to swiftly crush any organized resistance out in the open, hoping to stop the order before they reached the city, and then to run down anyone who tried to escape the city after the troops were sent in. Had the commanders been properly in control of the situation and their men, Nicky doubted they would have allowed such a crazy cavalry charge into the confines of a city. Nicky, of course, had known all that when she went to whack the hornet's nest. The folly of a cavalry attack into a city was becoming all too apparent. The killing was as swift as it was brutal. The gruesome sight of so many horses and men torn open seemed somehow unreal. The stench of blood was gagging. When she saw a column of the enemy turn down an alleyway to make an escape, Nicky cast her Han outward, using a concentrated spike of force to snap the bones of the lead horse. As the animal's legs folded under it, the horses following crashed into it at full speed, breaking their legs as the first horse rolled under them before they were able to leap up out of the way. A few of the horses following behind, seeing what was happening and having more time to react, were able to jump clear. Nicky saw the men at the far end of the narrow alleyway close off their escape route. Nicky cut around the corner to reach the main bottleneck and help prevent any Imperial Order cavalry from escaping the trap. As she rounded the final building, she encountered a knot of cavalry as they broke through the lines of men with spears. Nicky sent a molten ball of flame howling toward the enemy. It cleared the heads of the defenders and hit the street, splashing liquid fire across the horses' flanks. The animals, their hides on fire, reared up, allowing the flames to roll up onto the men on their backs. Nicky raced around tightly packed buildings to come up behind the tail end of the center trap that had ensnared a large number of the enemy. The men of the city had already set upon them. For once, the cavalrymen were outnumbered, disorganized, and unable to break free of the onslaught. Men fighting for their freedom had a burning determination that the soldiers had not expected to encounter. Their tactics of intimidation and simple slaughter had fallen apart. In the fading light of dusk, Nicky spotted Victor swinging a heavy mace at any Imperial Order head he could find. She urged Sadine through the slaughter.
"Victor!"
The man looked up with a murderous scowl.
"What?"
he cried out over the din of the battle, blood dripping from the steel blades of his weapon. Nicky stepped her horse closer.
"The soldiers are coming right behind the cavalry. They will be the real test. We don't dare let them change their mind about attacking now. Just in case they are having any second thoughts, I'm going to give them something irresistible to chase into the city."
Victor flashed her a grim grin.
Good. We will be ready for them.
Once the army poured into Altarang, there was no way they would be able to stay together. They would split up to move down different streets. Once they did that, each of those groups could be further divided by the defenders. As each group fled or charged, they would face hidden archers and groups of men with spears, to say nothing of the numerous traps. Altarang was huge. As darkness took the city, many of the invaders would become disoriented and lost. Because of the narrow warren of streets, they wouldn't be able to stay together to present a coordinated attack. They would not be allowed to go where they wished, as they wished, attacking helpless people. They would be relentlessly pursued and harried. Each group would get smaller all the time, both because they would be whittled down while under constant attack, and because some of their men would try other routes to find a way to safety. Nikki had made sure that there was no place of safety in the city.
"There is blood all down the front of you,"
Victor called up to her.
"Are you all right?"
"I got clumsy and fell off my horse. I'm fine. This must end tonight," she reminded Victor.
"In a hurry to go after Richard?"
She smiled, but didn't answer his question.
"I'd better go whack the hornet's nest. I will bring them on my heels."
He nodded.
"We're ready."
When she spotted three soldiers in the distance trying to make an escape without their horses, Nikki paused to cast a shimmering spell down a narrow, twisting street. With three rapid thuds, the lance of power slammed through flesh and bone to drop all three.
"And Victor," she said, turning back to the man, "there's one last thing."
"What would that be?"
"No one gets away alive. No one."
With the sounds of battle raging behind him, he appraised her eyes for a moment.
"I understand. Ishak will be waiting for you. Try to get the hornet's nest there as quickly as you can."
Nikki, checking the reins to hold Sadine in place, nodded.
"I will bring the soldiers right down."
She turned to the sudden whoosh of flame. Great gouts of fire flared up to the east. She knew that it could mean only one thing. Victor cursed and climbed up to stand on the carcass of a dead warhorse as he craned his neck, trying to get a view over the rooftops at the thick smoke billowing up into the darkening sky. He cast a suspicious scowl at Nikki.
"You failed to get Kronos?"
"I got Kronos," she growled through gritted teeth. "And another wizard. It would appear that they have another gifted with them. I guess they came prepared."
Nikki laid the reins over, turning Sadine toward the distant sounds of screams.
"But they didn't come prepared for death's mistress."
Chapter 29.
"What do you think it could mean?" Berdine asked.
Verna glanced over at the moored Sith's blue eyes.
"And didn't say."
The library was dead quiet but for the soft hiss of oil lamps. What with the row upon row of aisles along with the woodwork and shelves of dark walnut, the lamps and candles did little to illuminate the vast inner sanctuary. Had Verna lit all of the reflector lamps lining the walls and hung on the end caps of shelves, the place could have been made to be considerably brighter, but for their purpose, she didn't think it necessary. In a way, Verna felt that if they were to light too many lamps, pull out too many ancient volumes, disturb the sanctum to a large degree, it might wake the ghosts of all the master Rawls who haunted the place. Heavy beams divided the dark frame and panel woodwork of deep-set ceiling coves. Gilded carvings of vines and leaves meandered up columns to the side that supported those massive timbers. Strange yet beautiful symbols were painted in rich colors across the faces of the beams. Underfoot were spread luxurious carpets woven with elaborate designs in muted colors. And everywhere, around the outer walls and cases behind glassed doors, and in freestanding shelves marching through the library in orderly row upon row, were books by the thousands. Their leather bindings, mostly in deep colors, with at least some gold or silver leaf on the spines, added a rich, mottled texture to the place. Verna had rarely seen libraries so grand. The vaults at the Palace of the Prophets, where she had spent a great deal of time in study, had also held thousands of books, but the place had been utilitarian, serving only the function of storing books and providing a practical place to read them.
This palace revealed a reverence for the books and the knowledge they contained. Knowledge was power, and throughout the ages, each Lord Rol in turn had such power at his fingertips. Whether or not he used that knowledge wisely was another question. The only problem with such vast amounts of information would be accessing a specific item, or even knowing that it existed in such an immense collection. Of course, in times long past, there would have been scribes who, besides their work of making copies of important works, attended the libraries and were responsible for specific sections. The master could then easily ask a few relevant questions, narrowing the search to the individual dedicated to the particular area of interest, and be pointed in the right direction. Now, without such specialists tending the libraries, the priceless information contained in the countless volumes was considerably more difficult to retrieve. In a way, the magnitude of information became a hindrance to its own purpose and, like a soldier carrying so many weapons he couldn't move, nearly useless. The books held in this one library alone represented almost an unimaginable amount of work by countless scholars and a great many prophets. A short stroll through the aisles had revealed works here on history, geography, politics, the natural world, and prophecy that Verna had never seen before. A person could spend a lifetime lost in the place, and yet, Berdine had said that the People's Palace had a number of such libraries, from some that a variety of people were allowed to visit, to some that no one but the Lord Rol and, Verna assumed, his most trusted confidants could enter. This library was one of the latter. Berdine had said that because she knew High Daharan, Darkin Rol had sometimes brought her into the most private of the libraries to get her opinion on translations of obscure passages in ancient texts. As a result, Berdine was in a unique position to know at least something about the wealth of potentially hazardous knowledge stored in the palace. Not all prophecy was equally troublesome, though. A lot of it turned out to be incidental and rather harmless. What most people didn't realize was that a lot of prophetic space was taken up with what amounted to little more than the stuff of gossip. But by no means was all prophecy so congenial or frivolous, and wandering through the titillating trivia of everyday lives tended to lull one into complacency, and then when you least expected it, dark things came out of the pages to snatch at your soul. While there were volumes that were by and large completely harmless, there were others that were, for anyone but the untrained, unsafe from the first words to the last. This particular library held some of the most dangerous books of prophecy Verna knew of, books that at the Palace of the Prophets were considered so volatile that they were not kept in the main vault, but in smaller, heavily shielded vaults restricted to all but a handful of people at the palace. The presence of those books was probably the reason why this particular library was a very private retreat for Master Rol alone. Verna seriously doubted that the guards would have allowed her in had a moored Sith not been escorting her. Verna could happily spend a great deal of time in such a cozy place, exploring countless books she had never seen before. Unfortunately, she didn't have the luxury of time. She idly wondered if Richard had ever even seen what was now his as the Lord Rol. Berdine tapped a finger to the blank page in the Glendhill Book of Deviation Theory. "I'm telling you, prelate, I studied this book with Lord Rol at the Wizard's Keep in Adendrill." "So you said." Verna found it interesting, to say the least, that Richard knew of the Glendhill Book of Deviation Theory. She found it even more curious, considering his distaste for prophecy and the fact that this book of prophecies was mostly about him, that he'd studied it. There seemed no end to the curious little things that from time to time Verna discovered about Richard. Part of his dislike for prophecy, she knew, was his aversion to riddles. He hated them. She also knew, though, that in large measure his animus toward prophecy was due to his belief in free will, his belief that he himself, and not the hand of destiny, made his own life what it was. While enormously complex and with layers of meaning beyond most people's comprehension, prophecy certainly did revolve around core elements of the preordained in its nature. And yet Richard had more than once fulfilled prophecy while at the same time proving it wrong. Verna sourly suspected that, in a perverse way, prophecy had foretold of Richard's birth just so that he could come into the world to prove the concept of prophecy invalid. Richard's actions had never been easy to predict, even, or perhaps especially, for prophecy. In the beginning, Verna had been baffled by the things he would do, and was perpetually unable to predict how he would react to situations or what he might do next. She had come to learn, though, that what she had thought was his confounding switching in a blink from one matter to something completely unrelated was simply, at its core, his singular consistency. Most people were not able to remain riveted to a goal with such dedicated determination. They tended to become distracted by a variety of other urgent matters requiring their attention. Richard, as if in a sword fight with a number of opponents at once, prioritize those ancillary events, holding them in abeyance or dispatching them, as need be, while always keeping his goal firmly fixed in his mind. It sometimes gave people the false impression that he was skipping from one unrelated thing to another, when in reality he was, to him, innocently dancing across rocks in the river of events around him as he worked his way steadily toward the opposite bank. At times he was the most wonderful man Verna had ever met. At other times, the most exasperating. She'd long ago lost track of how often she had wanted to strangle him. Besides being the man born to lead them in the final battle, he had by force of his own will become their leader, the Lord Rawl, the linchpin of everything she had struggled for as a sister of the light. Just as prophecy foretold, but not at all in the manner it had so carefully laid out. Perhaps more than anything else, he meant to them all, Verna valued Richard as a friend. She ached for him to be happy, the way she had once been happy with Warren. Her time with Warren after they were married and before he had been killed had been the most alive she had ever felt. Since then, she felt like the living dead, alive, but not part of life. Verna hoped that someday, maybe when they finally won the struggle against the Order, that Richard could find someone to love. He loved life so much. He needed someone to share that with. She smiled inwardly. From the first day she had met him and put the collar around his neck to take him back to the Palace of the Prophets to be trained to use his gift, her life had felt as if it had been caught up in the whirlpool that was Richard. She vividly remembered that snowy day back at the Mud People's village when she had taken him away. It had been profoundly sad, because it had been against his will, and at the same time, it had been a momentous relief after having searched for him for 20 years. To be sure, he had not gone willingly into such benevolent captivity. In fact, two of the sisters with Verna had died in the effort to make Richard put on that collar he so hated. Verna frowned. Put on the collar. That was odd. She tried to recall exactly how it was that she had managed to get him to put the collar around his neck, as it had to be done. Richard hated collars, especially after having once been a captive of a moored Sith, and yet he had put it on of his own free will. For some peculiar reason, though, she couldn't seem to recall just how she had managed to get him to... Verna, this is really strange. The brown leather of Berdine's outfit creaked as she leaned in a little more, peering intently at the last of the text in the ancient volume laid open on the table before her. She carefully turned a page, checking, and then turned it back. She looked up. I know this book had writing in it before. That writing is now missing. As Verna watched the candlelight dance in Berdine's blue eyes, she set aside memories from long ago and returned her full attention to the important matters at hand. But it wasn't this book now, was it? When Berdine frowned, Verna went on to explain. It may have been the same title, but it wasn't this very book. You were at the keep. It was a different copy of this book, yes? Well, sure. I guess you're right that it wasn't this actual book. Berdine straightened and scratched her head of wavy brown hair. But if it's the same title... then why do you think that the copy at the Wizard's Keep has all the writing in it, while this one has big sections of the writing missing? I didn't say that the copy there still has all the writing in it. I'm only saying that the copy at the Keep, not this one, was the one you studied with Richard. That you recall reading it and not seeing any blank pages doesn't prove anything because it wasn't this very same book. But even more importantly, this book might in fact be identical in that it contains all the same text. But the scribe who made this duplicate might have simply left blank pages among that text for any number of reasons. Berdine looked skeptical. What reasons? Verna shrugged. Sometimes books with incomplete prophecy, such as these here, have blank places left in them to provide room for future prophets to finish the prophecy. Berdine planted her fists on her hips. Fine, but answer me one question. When I look through this book, I recall the things I'm reading. I may not understand most of it, but I remember it in a general sense, remember reading these passages. So why is it that I can't remember a single thing about the sections that are missing from the book? The simple explanation is that you don't recall anything of the blank sections because they are simply that, blank places, as I said, that were left in the book by the person who made the copy. No, that's not what I mean. I mean, I recall the general nature of the prophecies, the length of them. As a gifted person, you would be more attuned to what you're reading. I wouldn't. Since I never really understood these prophecies, I instead remember more of the way they looked. I remember how long they were. These are no longer complete. I didn't understand them, and I remember how long they seemed and how hard it was to make sense of such long prophecies. When something is hard to understand, it always seems longer than it really is. No! Berdine screwed up her face with conviction. That's not it! She turned to the last prophecy and tapped the page. This one here is only a page long, followed by a number of blank pages. I can't say that I remember the others so well, but for some reason I paid more attention to the last one. I'm telling you I remembered that this one for sure was a lot longer. I can't swear to how long the others were, or how long this one is supposed to be, but I do know for certain that this last one, at least, was more than a page. It wasn't incomplete, as this one here is now. No matter how hard I try, I can't seem to remember how long it was or what it said, but I know that it was more than a single page. That was the confirmation Verna had been waiting for. While most of it makes little sense to me, Berdine went on, I do remember this part, this beginning, having to do with all the talk about a forked source, and the confusing business about going back to a mantic root, and then the splitting the horde that vaunts the Creator's cause. That part at least sounds like the Imperial Order, but I can't recall the rest of it that's blank after a leader's lost trust. I'm not imagining it, Verna, I'm not. I can't say why I'm so sure that the rest of it is missing, but I am. And therein lies what has me so bothered. Why is the part that's missing from the book missing from my memory? Verna leaned close and lifted an eyebrow. Now, that, my dear, is the question I find troubling. Berdine looked startled. You mean, you know what I'm talking about? You believe me? Verna nodded. I'm afraid so. I didn't want to plant the seed of suggestion in your mind. I wanted you to confirm my own suspicions. Then this is what Anne was concerned about. What she wanted us to check? It is. Verna shuffled through the disorderly jumble of books on the sturdy table, finally pulling out the one she wanted. Look here at this book. This is the one that is perhaps the most troubling to me. Collected Origins is an exceedingly rare prophecy in that it was written entirely in story form. I studied this book before I left the Palace of the Prophets to search for Richard. I practically knew the story by heart. Verna fanned through the pages. The book is now entirely blank, and I can't remember a single thing about it except that it had something to do with Richard. Exactly what, I have no idea. Berdine studied Verna's eyes the way only a moored Sith could study someone's eyes. So this is some kind of trouble, and that trouble is a threat to Lord Rahl. Verna let out a deep breath. The flames of several of the closer candles fluttered as she did so. I'd be lying if I said otherwise, Berdine. While the missing text doesn't all have to do with Richard, it all pertains to a time after his birth. I don't have a clue as to the nature of the problem, but I admit that it has me greatly concerned. Berdine's demeanor changed. Usually the woman was the most good-natured of any of the Mord Sith that Verna knew. Berdine had a kind of simple childlike glee about the world around her. At times she could be heartwarmingly curious. Despite hardships that had others complaining, Berdine usually wore an unaffected smile. But at the impression of some kind of threat to Richard, she changed in a flash to all business, and now she had turned as suspicious and coldly menacing as any Mord Sith ever was.
"What could be the cause of this?" Berdine demanded. "What does it mean?"
Verna closed the book full of blank pages.
"I don't know, Berdine, I really don't. Anne and Nathan are as puzzled as we are, and Nathan is a prophet."
"What does that part about people losing trust in their leader mean?"
For an ungifted person, Berdine had managed to single out the most crucial part of a very oblique prophecy.
"Well," Verna said, cautiously framing her answer, "it could mean a number of things. It's hard to tell."
"Maybe hard for me, but not hard for you."
Verna cleared her throat.
"I'm not an expert in prophecy, you understand, but I think it has something to do with Richard."
"I know that much. Why would this prophecy talk about people losing trust in him?"
"Berdine, prophecy is rarely as straightforward as it seems."
Verna wished the woman would stop staring at her.
"What it seems to say usually has nothing at all to do with the actual event involved in the body of the prophecy."
"Prelate, this prophecy seems to me to suggest that questions of soundness of mind are going to be the cause of a leader's lost trust.
Since this prophecy names the leader as the one opposed to the horde that vaunts the Creator's cause, that would be the Imperial Order, that means it has to be talking about Lord Rawl. It then follows that Lord Rawl is the leader in whom people will lose trust. It comes after the part about the splitting of the horde, which the Order has now done. That makes the threat imminent."
Verna felt sorry for anyone who ever made the unfortunate mistake of underestimating Berdine.
"It is my experience that prophecy sometimes tends to fret over Richard like a doting grandparent. This sounds to me like a specific threat."
Verna folded her hands before herself.
"Berdine, you are a very smart woman, so I hope you can understand why it would be a grave mistake for me to argue or even discuss this prophecy with you. Prophecy is beyond the mind of the ungifted. It has little to do with how smart a person is. Prophecy is a creation of the gifted and meant only for those who are gifted in the same way. They are not even intended for other types of wizards. Even us sisters, talented sorceresses though we may be, had to train for years before we were allowed to even look at prophecy, much less work with it. It is exceedingly dangerous for the untrained to hazard guesses at the meaning of prophecy. You may recognize the words, but you do not recognize the meaning of those words."
"That's silly. Words are words. They have meaning. That is how we can understand the world around us. Why would prophecy take words that mean something and use them for some other unknown meaning?"
Verna felt as if she were stepping gingerly through a field of bear traps.
"That isn't exactly what I meant by what I said. Words can be used to make people understand, to explain, to veil, and to interpret the world. But they can also be used to explain things that are only speculation. If I foretell that dark times will come into your life, those words may be true, but it could mean that you will suffer a loss that will sadden you, or it could mean that you will be murdered. Though the words might be true, their exact meaning is not yet known. It would be a grave injustice to use those words as a reason to start killing everyone around you because the words made you fear you would be murdered. Wars have started over such misunderstandings about prophecy. People have died as the result of the untrained hearing what they think are the simple words of prophecy. That is why the books of prophecy were kept in secure vaults below the palace of the prophets.
These books of prophecy are not kept in vaults?
Berna's brow drew down as she leaned toward the moored Sith.
Perhaps they should be.
Are you saying that I'm wrong in what I believe this prophecy says?
Berna heaved another sigh. Right or wrong is impossible to discern in this instance. We can't even begin to intelligently dissect this prophecy because it's incomplete. We have here only the beginning of it and then a number of blank pages. So it could be just as you say, that it's about Richard and people will question his judgment and lose faith in him. But maybe the missing text says that the issue will be resolved the next day by some other event of consequence, and they will think more of him than they ever had before. Not only can prophecy be forked, meaning that it may be an either-or kind of statement, but the same prophecy could mean opposite things.
I don't see how it can mean opposite things, and how could something happen in the missing text of this prophecy to change people's minds?
Verna shrugged as she gazed around the vast, dimly lit library, trying to think of an example.
Well, say that they thought his battle plan was crazy. Maybe the army officers think it ill-advised. That could be something that would result in this prophecy, in people losing faith in him. Then, say that, despite the advice of officers, Richard insists, and so, despite their doubts and lack of faith, the soldiers follow his plan as ordered and achieve a victory that they never thought they could win. Their faith in Richard as their leader would be restored, and they would probably have even more respect for his judgment than they ever did before. But if the prophecy were to be acted upon without understanding its true meaning, those actions very well could countermand the rest of the event as it would have taken place naturally, and give the illusion that the prophecy had been fulfilled, but in fact the real and truly prophesied events had been bypassed by foolishly invoking a misinterpretation of the actual prophecy.
Berdine, watching Verna the whole time, drew her single brown braid through a loose fist.
I guess that could make sense. You see, Berdine, why prophecy is so confusing even for those of us trained in it? But to make matters worse, without the whole prophecy we dare not even begin to try to understand them or to assign any significance to them. The complete text is indispensable if one is to even begin to try to understand prophecy. Without all the text, it's as if prophecy has gone blind. That's one reason why this is so disturbing.
One reason? Berdine looked up again, still running her braid through her fist. What is the other reason?
It's bad enough to be without the text that was previously there, but the cause behind such an unprecedented event, the text of prophecy vanishing, is troubling in the extreme.
I thought you just said that we shouldn't jump to conclusions when it comes to prophecy.
Verna cleared her throat, feeling as if one of those bear traps just snapped closed on her leg.
Well, that's true, but it's obvious that something is going on.
Berdine folded her arms as she pondered the problem.
What do you think could be happening?
Verna shook her head.
I can't begin to imagine. Such a thing, to my knowledge, has never happened before. I have no idea why it's happening now.
But you think it's trouble that involves Lord Rawl?
Verna gave Berdine a sidelong look. The simple fact that so much of prophecy involves him makes that conclusion impossible to avoid. Richard is born to trouble. He is at the center of it.
Berdine didn't appear to like that one bit.
That is why he needs us.
I've never argued that he didn't.
Berdine relaxed, if only a notch, and flicked her braid back over her shoulder.
No, you have not.
Anne is searching for him. Let's hope she can find him, and soon. We need him to lead us in the coming battle.
As Verna spoke, Berdine idly pulled a book from one of the glass cases and began leafing through it.
Lord Rawl is supposed to be magic against magic, not the steel against steel.
That is a Daharan proverb. Prophecy says that he must lead us in the final battle.
I suppose, Berdine mumbled without looking up as she slowly turned pages.
With part of Jigang's forces headed south around the mountains, we can only hope that Anne will find him in time and bring him to us.
Berdin was puzzling at the book.
What is it that is buried with the bones?
What?
Berdin was still frowning as she tried to work out something in the book.
This book caught my attention before because it says Fuergrisse Ostraca on the cover. That's High Daharan. It means
the bringer of death.
Berdin glanced up.
Yes, how did you know?
There was a widely known prophecy that the sisters back at the Palace of the Prophets used to debate. It had actually been hotly debated for centuries. The first day I brought Richard to the palace, he declared himself to be the bringer of death, and thus named himself to be the one in the prophecy. It caused quite a stir among the sisters, I can tell you. One day, down in the vaults, Warren showed Richard the prophecy, and Richard himself solved the riddle of it, although to Richard, it wasn't a riddle. He understood it because he had lived portions of the prophecy.
This book has a lot of blank pages in it.
No doubt. It sounds like it's about Richard. There are probably a great number of books here that are about him.
Berdin was reading again.
This is in High Daharan. Like I said, I know High Daharan. I would have to work at it to be able to translate it more completely, and it would help if there wasn't so much missing text, but this place is apparently talking about Lord Rawl. It says something like, what he seeks is buried with the bones, or maybe even what he seeks is buried bones, something like that.
Berdin looked up at Verna.
Any idea what that's about? What it could mean?
What he seeks is buried bones? Verna shook her head with regret.
I have no idea. There are probably countless volumes here that have interesting or puzzling or frightening things to say about Richard. As I told you, though, with copy missing, what is there is next to useless.
I suppose, Berdin said in disappointment.
What about central sites?
Central sites?
Yes, this book mentions places called central sites.
Berdin stared off as she considered something to herself.
Central sites. Kolo mentioned something about central sites.
Kolo?
Berdin nodded. It's a journal written ages ago, during the Great War. Lord Rawl found the book at the Wizard's Keep, in the room with the sliff. The man who kept the journal is named Kolo Blyson. In High Daharan, the name means strong advisor. Lord Rawl and I call him Kolo for short.
What did this Kolo have to say about these places, these central sites? What are they?
Berdin turned through the pages of the book she held.
I don't recall. It was nothing I understood at the time, so I didn't devote a lot of effort to it. I'd have to go study it again to refresh my memory.
She squinted in recollection.
It seemed like there was something buried at the places called central sites. I can't remember if it said what was buried.
The Mord Sith stood frozen in her same pose as she studied the little book.
I was hoping this might give me a clue.
Verna let out a heavy sigh as she glanced around at the library.
Berdin, I would love to stay and spend time researching all these books. I would truly like to know what this library and the others here at the palace contain. But there are more pressing matters at hand. We need to get back to the army and my sisters.
Verna took a last look around.
Before I go, however, there is one thing here at the people's palace that I would like to check on. Maybe you can help me.
Berdin reluctantly closed the book and replaced it on the shelf. She carefully closed the glass door.
All right, prelate. What is it you want to see?
Chapter 30. Verna paused at hearing the single, long peal of a bell.
What was that?
Devotion, Berdin said, stopping to look back at Verna as the deep toll reverberated through the vast marble and granite halls of the people's palace. People, no matter where they seemed to be headed, turned and instead moved toward the broad passageway from where the deep resonant sound of the bell had come. No one looked to be in a hurry, but they all very deliberately walked toward the slowly dying sound of the bell. Verna puzzled at Berdin.
What?
Devotion. You know what a devotion is.
You mean a devotion to the Lord Rawl, that devotion?
Berdine nodded. The bell announces that it is time for the devotion.
Pensively, she gazed off in the direction of the hall where people were headed. Many of the gathering crowd were dressed in robes of a variety of muted colors. Verna assumed that white robes with gold or silver banding on them were the mark of officials of one sort or another who lived and worked at the palace. They certainly had the manner and bearing of officials. Everyone from those administrators to messengers in tunics trimmed in green and carrying leather satchels with an ornate letter R on them, standing for the House of Rawl, continued their casual conversations even as they made their way to the convergence of wide halls. Other people who worked at any of the countless variety of shops were dressed more appropriately for their profession, whether it be working at leather, silver, pottery, cobbling, or tailoring, providing the many foods and services, or doing any of the various palace work from maintenance to cleaning. There were a number of people dressed in the simple clothes of farmers, tradesmen, and merchants, many with their wives and some with children. Like those Verna had seen in the lower levels within the great plateau atop which sat the people's palace, or at the market set up outside, they appeared to be visitors come to trade or make purchases. Others, though, were dressed in finery for their sojourn to the palace. From what Verna had learned from Berdine, there were rooms that guests could rent if they wished to stay for an extended period. There were as well quarters for the many people who lived and worked at the palace. Most of the people in robes walked calmly, as if this were just another part of their day. Those dressed in finery tried to look just as calm and not stare at the exquisite architecture of the palace, but Verna saw their wide eyes wandering. The simply dressed visitors, as they fell in with the flow of all the people making their way toward the fork that would take them to the passageway with the bell, openly peered about at everything, at the towering statues of men and women in proud poses carved from variegated stone, at polished two-story fluted columns soaring past balconies, at the spectacular black granite and honey onyx floors. Verna knew that such intricate and precise patterns in the stone floors set with such tight grout joints could have been created only by the most talented master craftsman in all of the New World. Serving as prelate at the Palace of the Prophets for a time, she had had to deal with the matter of the replacement of a section of beautifully patterned floor that had in the dim past been damaged by young wizards in training. The precise events leading to the damage and who exactly had been the guilty party remained shrouded in oaths not to tattle. But the result was that the bit of mischievous magic had in an instant torn up a long section of exquisitely laid marble floor. While the debris and loose tiles had long since been removed, the floor sat damaged for decades, filled in with serviceable but unsightly limestone, while life at the Palace of the Prophets moved on. The palace attitude toward the boys had been one of indulgence, in part out of a sense of regret for having to hold such young men against their will. Verna had always been vexed that the damage had never been fixed, in part because by not fixing it, it represented to her an attitude that had indulged such bad behavior. It had always seemed like she was the only one, except maybe until Richard came along, who was bothered by seeing such beauty marred. Richard expected the boys there to take the responsibility for their actions. Even though he was held against his will, he never tolerated such senseless, destructive behavior. Warren saw matters the same way as Richard. Perhaps that was part of the reason they had become such fast friends. Warren had always been serious and dedicated about everything. After Richard had left the palace, Warren had reminded Verna that as the new prelate she no longer needed to complain about either the behavior or the floor. He encouraged her to act on her convictions. So, as prelate, she both set new rules and set about seeing to the completion of the repairs to the floor. That was when she had come to learn a thing or two about such floors and that while there were any number of men who boldly professed to be master craftsmen, very few actually were. Those who were let their work make clear the distinction. The former made the task a nightmare, the latter a joy.
She remembered how proud Warren had been of her for seeing the task through and for not accepting anything less than the best. She missed him so much. Verna gazed around at the spectacular palace, at the intricate stonework, and yet such beauty now failed to move her. Since Warren had died, everything seemed bland, uninteresting, and unimportant to her. Since Warren had died, life itself seemed drudgery. Everywhere throughout the palace, wary soldiers patrolled, probably not ever realizing or even considering the staggering amount of human imagination, skill, and effort that had gone into the creation of such a place as the People's Palace. Now they were a part of it, a part of what kept it viable, like thousands of men just like them who for centuries had walked these same halls and kept them safe. Verna noticed that some of the guards moved through the halls in pairs, while others patrolled in larger groups. The muscular young men were dressed in smart uniforms with molded leather shoulder and breastplates, and all carried at least a sword. Many of the soldiers also carried pikes with gleaming metal points. Verna noticed special guards who wore black gloves and carried crossbows slung over their shoulders. The quivers at their belts held red fletched bolts. The soldiers' eyes were always on the move, watching everything. "I seem to recall Richard mentioning the devotion," Verna said, "but I didn't think that they still did it when the Lord Rawl wasn't at the palace, and especially not since Richard became the Lord Rawl." Verna hadn't exactly meant it to be condescending, although she realized after she'd said it that it must have sounded that way. It was just that Richard was, well, Richard. Verdine glanced at Verna askance. "He is still the Lord Rawl. We are no less bonded to him because he is away. The devotion is always done at the palace, whether the Lord Rawl is here or not. And regardless of how you may view him, he is the Lord Rawl by every measure. We have never had a Lord Rawl we respected as much as we respect him. That makes the devotion more meaningful and more important than it ever was before." Verna kept her mouth shut, but she cast Berdine a look that came all too easily to her as a sister of the light, and now as prelate. Even though she understood the reasons behind it, she was the prelate of the Sisters of the Light, devoted to seeing the Creator's will done. As a Sister of the Light, living at the Palace of the Prophets under the spell that slowed their aging, she had seen rulers come and go. The Sisters of the Light never bowed down to any of them. She reminded herself that the Palace of the Prophets was gone. The Imperial Order now controlled many of the Sisters. Berdine lifted an arm, indicating the palace around them. "The Lord Rawl makes all this possible. He gives us a homeland. He is the magic against magic. His rule keeps us safe. While in the past we have had masters who regarded the devotion as a demonstration of servitude, its origin is actually nothing more than an act of respect." Verna's aggravation seethed just below the surface. This was not some mythic leader Berdine was talking about, some wise old king. It was Richard. As much as Verna respected and valued him, it was still Richard. Woods guide, Richard. Swiftly on the heels of her flash of indignation came regret for such unkind thoughts. Richard always fought for what was right. He had valiantly put his life in peril for his noble beliefs. He was also the one named in prophecy. He was also the Seeker. He was also the Lord Rawl, the bringer of death, who had turned the world upside down. Because of Richard, Verna was prelate. She wasn't sure if that was a blessing or a curse. Richard was also their last hope. "Well, if he doesn't hurry up and join up with us to lead the Daharan army in the final battle, there will be none of us left to respect him." Berdine withdrew her reproachful stare and unexpectedly started toward the passageway that turned off to the left, the one where the bell had rung. "We are the steel against steel. Lord Rawl is the magic against magic. If he doesn't come to fight with the army, it is only because of his duty to protect us all from the dark forces of magic." "Simple-minded gibberish," Verna muttered to herself as she hurried to catch up with the moored Sith. "Where are you going?" she called after the woman. "To devotion. At the palace, everyone goes to devotion." "Berdine!" Verna growled as she caught Berdine's arm. We don't have time for this.
It is devotion. It is part of our bond to Lord Rawl. You would be wise to go to devotion, and then maybe you will remember that.
Verna stood frozen in the vast hall, stunned, watching the moored Sith stalk off. Verna had a vivid memory of the time that the bond to Richard had been severed. It hadn't been for long, but in Richard's absence from the world of life, the protection of the bond to the Lord Rawl had ceased to exist. In that brief window in time, when Richard and the bond were gone from them all, Jagang had stolen into Verna's dreams to capture her mind. He had captured Warren as well. It had been beyond horror to have the Dreamwalker in control of her consciousness. But it had been all the worse to know that Warren was just as helpless. Jagang's brutal presence had dominated every aspect of their existence, from what they could think to what they had to do. They no longer had control of their own will. Jagang's will was all that mattered, just the memory of the searing pain that had been sent through that link into her and into Warren. Unexpectedly brought the sting of tears to Verna's eyes. She quickly swiped away the tears and hurried after Berdine. Verna had important things to do, but she would lose untold time trying to find her way all alone in the vast interior of the People's Palace. She needed the moored Sith to show her the way. If Verna had control of her gift, it might help her find what she sought. But in the palace, her Han was virtually useless. She would just have to go along with Berdine and hope that they could then get back to business without the loss of too much time. The passageway to the left led under an interior bridge with a rail and balusters made of gray marble, struck through with white veins. At a convergence of four passageways, the hall expanded into a square open to the sky. In the center of the square was a square pond with a short, polished, speckled gray granite seat all the way around, that held the water within it. A large pitted rock sat in the water a little off-center. Atop the rock sat the bell, apparently the one that had rung calling people to the devotion. Gentle rain had begun to fall in through the open roof. The surface of the pond danced with the drops. Verna saw that the floor all around the square was gently sloped toward drains in order to handle any rain. The clay tiles helped reinforce the realization that the square was really out of doors. All around the people were going to their knees, bowing down on the clay tile floor, facing the pond that held the now silent bronze bell. Berdine's dark discontent evaporated at seeing that Verna was coming with her. She smiled back happily and then did the strangest thing. She reached out and took Verna's hand. Come on, let me take you up by the pond. It has fish.
Fish?
Berdine's grin widened.
Yes, I love the squares with fish.
Sure enough, after they wove their way through all the people kneeling down on the floor and reached the front of the crowd close to the pond, Verna saw that there were schools of orange fish meandering through the water. There was hardly enough room for them to stand among all the people bowed down on the floor around them.
Aren't they pretty?
Berdine asked. She had that little girl air about her again. Verna glared at the young woman.
They're fish.
Berdine seemed unfazed and knelt in a spot that opened up as people moved aside for them. Verna could see by the sidelong glances that everyone had at least a healthy respect for the moored Sith, if not open fear. While none of them appeared frightened enough to leave, they clearly didn't want to be where Berdine wanted to be when she wanted to be there. They also seemed more than a little worried about who the moored Sith was dragging to the devotion, as if it might be a repentant sinner, and the lesson might involve bloodshed. Berdine glanced over her shoulder at Verna before leaning forward and placing her hands on the tile floor. The brief look had been an admonition for Verna to do the same. Verna saw that the guards were watching her. This was crazy. She was the prelate of the Sisters of the Light, an advisor to Richard and one of his close friends. But the guards didn't know that. Verna knew all too well that her power was diminished to next to nothing in the palace. This was the ancestral home of the House of Rawl.
The entire palace had been built in the shape of a spell form designed to enhance their power and deny others theirs. Verna let out a sigh and finally went to her knees, bowing forward on her hands like everyone else. They were close to the pond, but the opening in the roof was only about the size of the pond itself. So the rain was confined mostly to the pond and whatever stray rain the gentle breeze carried beyond. The few sprinkles that reached her actually felt rather refreshing, considering her heated mood. "I'm too old for this," Verna complained in a whisper to her devotion partner. "Prelate, you are a young, healthy woman," Berdine chided. Verna let out a sigh. It was no use arguing the foolishness of kneeling on the floor and saying a devotion to a man she was already devoted to in more ways than one. But it was more than foolish. It was silly, and a waste of time besides. "Master all guide us," the crowd all began together, if not all quite in harmony, as they bowed down and put their foreheads against the floor. "Master all teach us," they all said, coming more into unison. Berdine, her forehead against the tile, still managed to cast a fiery look Verna's way. Verna rolled her eyes and bent forward, placing her forehead against the tile. "Master Rawl, protect us," she muttered, finally joining in with the devotion she knew and had already once given to Richard himself. "In your light we thrive, in your mercy we are sheltered, in your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours." Verna sourly considered how, if Richard didn't wisely hurry up and get his hide to the Daharan army, he wasn't going to be able to protect anyone. Together, the assembled throng softly chanted the devotion again. "Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours." Verna leaned a little toward Berdine and whispered, "How many times are we going to have to say the devotion?" Berdine, looking very much the moored Sith, shot Verna a stern glare. She didn't say anything. She didn't have to. Verna recognized the look. She herself had countless times used the same look as she peered down her nose at novices who were misbehaving, or young wizards in training who were being mulish. Verna turned her eyes back to the tile under her, feeling very much like a novice again as she softly spoke the chant along with the rest of the people. "Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours." The murmur of the chanted devotion in the single joined voice of all the people gathered in the square echoed through the cavernous halls. After the look Berdine had given her, Verna thought it best if, for the time being, she kept her objections to herself and said the devotion along with everyone else. She spoke the words softly, thinking about them, and how many times they had proven true for her personally. Richard had changed everything about her life. Verna had thought that the most important mission for the sisters was to put a collar around gifted boys' necks and train them in the use of their ability. Richard had humbled her for that unthinking belief. He had changed everything, made her rethink everything. If not for Richard, Verna doubted that she would ever have been thrown together with Warren, and that their fondness for each other would have blossomed into love. In that, Richard had given her the greatest thing she had ever had in her life. "Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours." The cadence of the murmured words of all the voices of the gathered people joined into a reverent sound that swelled until it filled the great hall. Verna felt so all alone, even among the gathered crowd of so many people. She ached with how much she missed Warren. She had built a wall around her feelings and had shut herself away from such thoughts, as well as those around her,
hoping to be spared the pain that always seemed to lurk just below the surface. Now she was suddenly overwhelmed by the raw misery of how much she missed Warren, how much she loved him. He was the best thing that had ever happened in her entire life, and now he was gone. Tears from her hopeless heartache welled up. She felt so alone.
Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours.
Verna sucked back a sob as she remembered kissing Warren for the last time as he lay dying. That had been the most dreadful moment in her entire life. Despite the time that had passed, it seemed as if it had happened yesterday. She missed him so much that it made her bones ache.
Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours.
Verna spoke the words of the devotion along with everyone else, pouring her feelings into them over and over, yet without haste. The murmured chant filled her mind. She wept as she remembered the time she'd had with Warren. She remembered his last words to her.
"Give me a kiss," Warren had whispered, "while I still live, and don't mourn what ends, but what a good life we've had. Kiss me, my love."
Pain and longing twisted her insides. Her world was ashes. Nothing seemed worthwhile. She didn't want to live anymore.
Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours.
Verna choked back her sobs as she chanted the devotion. It never even occurred to her to wonder if anyone noticed her. It had all been so senseless, a young man of no ability for anything worthwhile, with no interest in any values, of no use to anyone, including himself, murdering Warren just to prove his loyalty to the cause of the Imperial Order, which was, in essence, that people like Warren had no right to live his own life, but instead should sacrifice themselves for the likes of his murderer. Richard fought to end such madness. Richard fought with everything he had against those who brought such senseless brutality to the world. Richard had given himself over to ending it so that others would not have to lose those they loved, as Verna had lost Warren. Richard truly understood her pain. Verna sank into the rhythm of the chant, allowing it to wash through her. Richard stood for everything she had fought for her whole life: solidity, meaning, purpose. A devotion to such a man, rather than being blasphemy, seemed altogether right. In a way, because of who Richard was and what he stood for, it was actually a devotion to life itself rather than some otherworldly goal. Richard had been Warren's good friend, his first real friend. Richard had brought Warren up out of the vaults and into the sunlight, into the world. Warren loved Richard. The soft chant had become a calming refuge. Verna felt a warm shaft of sunlight settling on her as it broke through the clouds. She was bathed in the gentle golden glow of light. It embraced her with its warmth that seemed to seep down and touch her very soul. Warren would want her to embrace all the precious beauty of life while she had it. In the loving touch of glowing light, she felt peace for the first time in ages.
Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours.
The soft flow of the words of the devotion as she knelt in the warm shaft of sunlight filled her with a profound calm, a serene sense of belonging unlike she ever had before. She whispered the words, letting them lift away the shards of pain. As she knelt, her head to the tiles, putting her heart and soul into saying the words, she felt free of any and every worry. She was suffused with the simple joy of life and with reverence for it. As she chanted along with everyone else, she basked in the tender glow of the sunlight. It felt so warm, so protective, so loving. It felt almost like Warren's loving embrace. As she chanted along with everyone else over and over, without pause but for breath, time slipped by, incidental, inconspicuous, unimportant within the core of calm she felt. The bell rang out twice, a low, mellow, comforting affirmation that the devotion had ended, but at the same time would always be there with her. Vernal looked up when she felt a hand on her shoulder. It was Berdine smiling down at her. Vernal looked around and saw that most of the people were already gone. She alone still bowed forward on her hands and knees on the floor before the pool. Berdine was kneeling beside her. "Verna, are you all right?" She straightened up on her knees.
"Yes. It's just that it felt so good in the sunlight."
Berdine's brow twitched. She glanced over at the drops of rain dancing in the water of the pond. "Verna, it has been raining the whole time." Verna peered around as she stood.
"But I felt it. I saw the glow of the shaft of light all around me."
Berdine seemed to catch on, then, and put a comforting hand on the small of Verna's back.
"I understand."
"You do?" Berdine nodded with a compassionate smile. "Going to devotion in a way gives you a chance to consider your life, and along with that it brings comfort in many forms. Maybe one who loves you came to comfort you." Verna stared at the soft smile on the moored Sith's face.
"Has it ever happened to you?"
Berdine swallowed as she nodded. Her eyes, brimming with tears, said that it had. Chapter 31. They followed what seemed like a meandering, wandering, convoluted course through the people's palace, not because they were lost or because they were taking their time and picking random routes as they came upon intersections of hallways, but because there was no straight route. The complex, confusing passage through the labyrinth was necessary because the palace had not been built to accommodate ease of travel through the palace, but rather, it had been constructed in the explicit shape of a power spell that had been drawn on the face of the ground. Verna found it astonishing to consider that this was not only a spell form similar to spells she herself had drawn, but that she was actually inside the elements that made up the spell. It was an entirely new perspective on conjuring and one on an imposing scale. Since the power spell for the House of Rawl was still active, she knew that the configuration of the foundation would probably have had to have been drawn first in blood, Rawl blood. As the two of them walked down vast halls, Verna could not get over her astonishment at the utter beauty of the place, to say nothing of its size. She had seen grand places in the past, but the sheer magnitude of the People's Palace was staggering. It was less a palace and more of a city in the desolate Azeroth Plains. The palace atop the immense plateau was only a part of the vast complex. The interior of the plateau was honeycombed with thousands of rooms and passageways, and there were innumerable stairs taking different routes up through the chambers inside. A great number of people sold goods and services in the lower reaches of the plateau. It was a long and tiring climb up endless flights of stairs to reach the elaborate palace at the top. So many of the visitors who came to trade or make purchases did their business in those lower reaches, never taking the time to make it all the way up to the palace proper at the top. Even more people did business at open-air markets around the base of the plateau. There was a single winding road, interrupted by a drawbridge, along the outside of the plateau. Even if it weren't heavily defended, it would still be virtually impossible to attack the palace by that road. The interior of the plateau offered many more ways up. There were even ramps used by horsemen. but there were thousands of troops guarding the inside passages, and if need be, there were colossal doors that could be closed, sealing off the plateau and the palace within. Black stone statues standing to either side of a wide white marble hallway watched Verna and Berdin as they made their way down the long hall. Torchlight glimmered off the polished black marble of the towering sentinels, making them seem almost alive. The contrasting color of stone, the black statuary in a white marble hall, added a sense of foreboding to the passage. Most of the stairwells they ascended were quite large, some with polished marble balustrades, more than an arm's length across. Verna found the variety of stone within the palace amazing. It seemed like each vast room, each passageway, each stairwell had its own unique combination of colors. A few of the more utilitarian or service areas that Berdin took them through were done in bland, beige limestone, while the more important public areas were composed of startlingly vivid colors in contrasting patterns that lent an uplifting sense of life and excitement to the space. Some of the private corridors that served as shortcuts for officials were paneled in highly polished woods, illuminated by silver reflector lamps that added warm light. While some of those private corridors were relatively small, the main passageways stood several stories high. Some of the largest, main branches of the spell form, were lit from above by windows in the roof that let the light stream in. Rows of soaring columns to each side rose to the roof far above. Balconies, between those fluted pillars, looked down on the people passing below. In several places there were walkways that crossed over Verna's head. In one spot, she saw two levels of walkways, one above the other. At times they had to go up to some of these higher levels, cross bridges over the passageways, and then descend again into a different branch of hallways, only to once more have to go back up in another place. Despite the up and down of the serpentine route, they steadily worked their way higher into the center of the palace. "Through here," Berdin said as she reached a pair of mahogany doors. The doors were twice as tall as Verna. Carved in the face of the thick mahogany were a pair of snakes, one on each door. Their tails coiled around branches higher up with their bodies hanging down so that the heads were at eye level. Fangs jutted out from gaping jaws, as if the pair were about to strike. The door handles, not much lower than the snake's heads, were bronze mellowed with a patina that spoke of its age. The handles were life-sized grinning skulls. "Lovely," Verna muttered. "They are a warning," Berdin said. "This is meant to command people to stay out." "Couldn't they just paint 'Keep out' on the door?" "Not everyone can read." Berdin lifted an eyebrow. "Not everyone who can't read will admit to it when caught opening the door. This gives them no excuse to cross the threshold innocently and lets them know that they will have no excuse when confronted by guards." From the chill that the sight of the doors gave her, Verna could imagine that most anyone would give them a wide berth. Berdin threw her weight into the effort of pulling open the heavy door on the right. Inside, a cozy, carpeted room paneled in the same mahogany as the tall doors, but without any more of the carved snakes, four big soldiers stood guard. They looked more fearsome than the bronze skulls. The closest soldier casually stepped into their path. "This area is restricted." Berdin, wearing a dark frown, skirted the man.
"Good. See to it that it stays that way."
This is the end of disc number 10. Please insert disc number 11.